It was a rare time, not terribly rare, doesn't happen very often, but you get your lesson done, and you look at your lesson, you start reading. I do a lot of times. I read other commentaries when I'm kind of done to see what else others have said, and I did that last night, and I picked up Robert Thomas's commentary on Revelation, and we're in Revelation chapter 7, by the way, first three verses, and this is different than when I got ready. And of course, Thomas has a high stature in my mind. He's a good commentary, has a good commentary, quotes too many other people that make no contribution, so it just makes his commentary too long. But anyway, I read what he wrote. I'll not tell you about this later, but I got to, man, what am I going to do with this? This is different. This is totally standing on his head from what I understood this passage to be saying. It's 8 o'clock at night. I can't go back and change everything. I'll be up till midnight, and I'm already tired. I already had a nap. So anyway, I let it go, and I said, well, I'll tell the class. This is how I see it. It may not be the right way to look at it. The others see it differently. And so I asked Scott, who's taught Revelation, and I asked him about the same passage, and he said, I don't know. He couldn't remember. And so he had John MacArthur's study Bible open it up to Romans, Revelation 7, 1 and 3. And MacArthur agreed with what I saw. And I said, okay, I can go to class. I got an authority behind me now. So, but can you imagine what it's like to have a lesson ready and find out that it's wrong? I mean, just like, ugh. When did you know it was wrong and what did you do about it? Huh? All right, well, maybe I don't have it right. But if there's at least one guy that's got some clout out there that has it the way I think of it, at least I've got some help. So that's kind of what we're going to do. And maybe you'll have an opinion about this yourself. I'm sure you will. So far in our study, we are up to chapter 7. We're actually going to get into 7 this week. The last two lessons, we paused to explain perhaps a theory, why God perpetrates these actions of judgment that we see in the book. And it occurred to me that a new reader of Revelation may get a wrong concept of God if they look at the severe judgment on the earth as without any purpose, other than venting God's anger, which conclusion you don't need to draw. Now, of course, God can vent his anger against sin and not sin. That's possible. But perhaps there is another reason that the tribulation is entered besides just the wrath of sin. Although, I got thinking, again, there are no emphatic conclusive statements because every act of God against sin is an act of wrath, except grace. All right, so maybe I overstated that. So the purpose suggested by my study, since the words regeneration, refreshing, set free, make all things new, are used to renovate the earth for the eternal kingdom, therefore one of the purposes of God is not only to destroy the earth, quote, quote, but to rebirth it for its paradise condition. And that's the model that I've been using here. The world became dangerous at the flood and other events up from the fall, four events. And the world will be restored at the tribulation and its restoration to the paradise that's been restored, which is the promised kingdom. And we have these verses. Don't want you to forget them. These are verses that talk about the beginning of the millennium. We have the assurance that the world, the habitat of man, by the way, the world is the habitat of man. God made it for him. Will return to its original state, God's original intent, because he says he's going to make all things new. That might be a question verse, although this week I found some more information about that I think is still the right view that I've been telling you, that all things new is still in the millennium. And in the regeneration, when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, obviously a millennium passage, heaven must receive until the restoration is over. That, again, is obviously a millennial passage. And the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption, which is also a millennial passage. So the backdrop assumption is a perfect eternal kingdom promised in the Old Testament to Abraham and David. So we have the world becomes dangerous, the world is restored, we go into the paradise plus kingdom. All right. Now, we stopped our advance of the study at the seventh seal. We didn't get into the seventh seal at the end of chapter 6. That's where we are. Now we're going to chapter 7. The body count rose to 25% of the world's population in verse 8 of chapter 6. Somebody suggested at the men's retreat, and I said, well, it's a possibility that one-fourth of the earth could mean one-fourth one-fourth of the space rather than the population. That's a possibility. Because it says one-fourth of the earth. We assume that it's then one-fourth of the population, but we don't necessarily think that the population is evenly, you know, distributed over the whole world. But it's a possibility. But I think it's probably better it's a people. It was then that we looked at the purpose for the two-week study. And that's what we came to the purpose to restore. All right. Now we move to chapter 7. And we are still in the sealed section of the tribulation after the 6th, but before the 7th. So it's kind of like an interlude in there. And this is what it says. And after this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, so that no wind would blow on the earth or on the sea or on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God, and he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea. Now, there is some question about the timing of these, since it's in an interlude. Is this something being told us that has already happened, or is this now happening for the first time? So it doesn't make a big difference to me here. I'm going to take it that this is a advance of information that doesn't go back. So there is some question about the timing of the appearance of the three angels, these angels, based on the choice of the manuscript, and that's the difference. One letter or one word changes it. One way it is, in NES, New American Standard, says, after this, the King James says, after these, so the whatever, indefinite pronouns there. So after this is what the New American Standard has, and that's what we're going to go with. And it seems best to understand that we have a sequence of information. In other words, he's telling us something that what has happened in chapter, the six seals, now something else is going to happen. It's not going to go back. So the difference is, has what is described in chapter 7 been going on during the first six seals, or is what is described in 7 covering a new period? In the first case, the 144,000, which is in chapter 7, have been commissioned earlier under the six seals, while if it is sequenced or added material, then the commissioning of the 144,000 happens after the sixth seal but before the seventh, which is what I think it is. It is shown that martyrs have already given their lives. This is why this question comes up. The martyrs have already given their lives even before the commissioning of the 144,000. That means evangelism was going on. If you're going to take that, this is new information. The 144,000 are now commissioned between 6 and 7. And you have new information. That means evangelism was going on without the 144,000 under the first six seals. Certainly a possibility, I would say, after the rapture, when the harvest of souls is likely from those who just realize they have been left behind. So you don't need to have an evangelist right away, because they understood, because the church has evangelized these people and they have refused it. And what they have been predicting will happen, the rapture, and they're left behind. They say, that's the apologetic. I've missed it. I don't need to have somebody else tell me. So don't need evangelists here. All right? So that's my argument. So you can have evangelism going on, or salvation going on, people being saved going on, even when the 144,000 aren't there. Now, I'm going to say one more thing later. I'll say it now so I don't, you know, get, for a full disclosure, I think the two witnesses are already in place. They talk about two witnesses later on. Because they witness or they minister for 1,260 days. So that means it's got to be in the first half. So they would minister for the whole first 3.5 years of the tribulation. Doesn't say that here, because we don't get that information until we get to chapter 11. So I'm just saying that they're probably all in place, and they be already part of why more souls are being saved here, and then why they are martyred, because they've been martyred because of their faith. No, really, if you understand what I'm trying to say here, I think that evangelism could go on without 144,000. Two reasons why it can go on. One is they have heard the gospel from family, friends, members, whatever, before the rapture, and they remember what they told them. Second possibility is the two evangelists are on CNN, Fox News, NBC, everywhere, telling their story, and the word's getting out about salvation and what has just happened. So I think evangelism goes on. We know it goes on because they're martyrs. that are waiting under the altar, so to speak, waiting for relief. Now we assume, this is getting to our text now, we assume that the four angels who control the winds are in the right order. They follow along before the seventh seal is opened. Normally you take things in order unless you can't. And it says, after this, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, so that no wind would blow on the earth or on the sea or any tree. Now, do you get the idea that there will be no winds blowing on the earth with this event? Do I read it again? After this, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding back four winds of the earth so that no wind would blow on the earth or on the sea or any tree. Now, I read that and I prepared my lesson on the basis that we're talking about winds that are not going to blow. Not winds that are going to blow. Somehow, when you read the commentaries, all of a sudden this wind that doesn't blow blows. All right, so these angels, they're talk about the four corners here. Four corners, four angels are four corners of the compass, worldwide effect. They hold back a normal advance of four winds of the earth. The withholding is for a short time. I'm not sure I can even say that it is for a short time. It doesn't say anything about its timeliness. MacArthur says for a short time, but I'm thinking, why are we saying a short time here? And I got some other real weird ideas about this, since the world has already lost. All the mountains have shaken out of the place. All islands have lost their place. And I'm wondering, has there something happened in the world that have changed the atmospheric condition, which would be a reverse of what happened to the flood? Is that what's being told here? I don't know. But all of a sudden, we're told that the winds will stop. But they're not stopped yet. The winds continue to flow until they're stopped. So remember that. It says in verse 2, and I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, which would be the east, the place where God comes from, grace comes from, judgment comes from. I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the mark, the ring, signet, stamp, to mark the 144,000, my addition there, but that's what the seal is for. It's not the seal of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6, not that seal. This is the seal of the mark. Having the seal of the living God, and he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels, the wind angels, to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea. Well, let's back up a little bit, since you didn't hear me say what I said. Again, in so many passages, we are confronted with a figure or a literal meaning? Is the wind literal or is it a figure? Sometimes I have to admit, and I'm in one of those, it's hard to distinguish, but remember that the results are not in dispute. Judgment always follows. What we might not know for sure is just how did that judgment happen, which is a secondary issue. So sometimes it's hard to distinguish, but the results are not in dispute. Severe earthly judgment. And there's no need, when you come up on a figure that you don't understand, there's no need, in fact, it's a wrong thing to allegorize these texts, as some do. Now, Barnhouse, a guy that's read in the past, I'm not hearing people read him so much today, sort of like the gold standard of commentators, said that it's allegory. Now, look at what he does with this. He says these symbols are easy to interpret. Everybody knows the earth is Israel, and the sea is the Gentiles, and the tree are those that are in authority. I said, these symbols are easy to interpret. How would you know that? Unless Barnhouse told you that. All right, so that's an example of allegory. See, the earth isn't the earth. Earth is the, who would I say here, Israel? The Gentiles, that's the sea, and the trees are the authorities. There's no connection here. So that's what's called allegorizing text. It does have no relationship to what the text says. And you see something out here, say, well, let's make these match. But they don't match. So why it's very important when you read commentaries that you read dispensational writers. I'll explain about that, I guess, as we go along. Again, and I saw the four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, the four compass points, holding back the four winds of the earth so that no wind would blow on the earth, no wind would blow on the earth and the sea or any tree. You notice that when you, how do you know when a wind blows? Tree bends, doesn't it? Or whatever else, but trees are what we see. Another angel sent her from the rising sun. Repeat this, having the seal, the ownership, not one of the seven seals of the living God. And he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels. Doom was granted to harm the earth and the sea. So the question is, if these are literal winds, or lack of winds, then we are told of, get it, real climate change. A stagnant atmosphere where no wind would blow will soon be polluted. No wind means no weather fronts, no temperature drops, only temperature rising, no rain, no scrubbing of the atmosphere, and I could go on. While we may not appreciate our 35-mile-hour winds this weekend, we are much better off with winds than no winds at all. This then forms the judgment in itself, the lack of winds, the lack of movement, the lack of refreshing the earth's atmosphere, the destruction of the earth's vegetation service and hardship of life without weather, movement of air, frontal system, rain, all that, is beyond our experience. I can't imagine that. I don't know if you've ever sat in a sauna. Some of you all have done that someplace at one time or another when you're still silly and thought it was a great experience. You sit there and what do? Sweat. You can't stand there very long, can you? Now, I'm not saying that the world's going to be a sauna, but it's going in that direction. And no way to escape for relief. So now all of a sudden, I think there's a judgment going on here. When the winds stop blowing, there is a judgment on the earth. Now, I think that's what the text says. And when I read some of the other guys saying, oh, the winds are not really that. Then they turn the winds into being stagnant. It's the winds that are blowing our judgment. Well, wait a minute. The winds are not being blown. The winds are being stopped. I'm getting off my subject. So I say this then, the stagnant atmosphere then becomes a destructive element in itself. And that's what John MacArthur says in his footnotes. That's what gave me hope to come to class this morning. On the other hand, if the winds are figures, they are figures of judgment, okay. As indicated, both options lead to, as I said, literal judgment. We're not escaping judgment here because we're not going to allegorize it. A figure is different because the end result is always the same, whether it's a figure or reality. The end result's always the same, judgment. In the former, the judgment is explained, the wind is explained as no wind. That's the judgment. In the second, the judgment is unspecified. Because this no wind turns into a wind, which is God's judgment. See, this no wind turns into a wind, which is God's judgment. That's what they do with this. It seems backwards to me. That's why I said, what am I going to do with this? All right, so I think, therefore, the no wind is literal, is a better option. If not, then the winds are symbols of unknown actions or judgments. If these are... Let's go with the crowd. If they say the winds blowing are the judgments, what are the judgments? They say, well, we don't know. Doesn't say. It's a clue, right? A little bit to me, it's a little clue. What are the judgments? We can't find nowhere else. Maybe I said this in here. In the former, the judgment is explained. The no wind is a judgment and explains. In the second, the judgments are unspecified. I think, therefore, the new wind. Okay, read that. Okay, if not, then the winds are the symbols of unknown actions or judgments. It could include the winds as tools of terror, and we've seen tornadoes, to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea. So there could be terror with winds. But it doesn't say that the winds are going to blow. It says the winds are going to stop blowing. So, supporting this idea, since nowhere in Revelation do we read of the four winds actually blowing, except here, they may be taken as representing the earthly catastrophes that occur under the temple and bowl judgment. That I don't agree with that. And that comes from Johnson, who is a commentator on the book of Revelation, or the Bible expositor Bible commentary. Don't want to undermine anybody's confidence in commentaries. But commentaries miss it a lot. That doesn't mean you shouldn't read them. So don't want to do that. Don't want to get yourself so isolated you don't read these guys, but you got to read them with understanding. And where the first place you read commentaries with understanding, start with dispensational writers, because you don't have to weed through all this allegory stuff. Okay, maybe we'll go on here. So my choice is, always the choice should be, to choose the simple, straightforward, although the alternative is an option. If this is God's judgment and the judgments are the winds blowing, fine. We're going to get to the same place. In my case, I know what that judgment is. In your case, I don't know what it is. And I don't have to know what it is to let God do what he does. But it seems to me like God is telling us what's happening here rather than not telling us what's happening here. So my choice is to choose the simple, straightforward, although the alternative is an option. I tend to resist a figurative reading unless the context warrants it. So these winds, this lack of winds, is not a figure, it is actual. In this case, there is no warrant to make it not actual, because a stagnant atmosphere can reasonably be a severe judgment in itself. Now, if a stagnant wind didn't bring judgment, then you say, well, maybe it's a figure. I'm not sure what kind of figure it would be, but it does bring judgment. And that's why I think some miss this, because perhaps some have not thought this through. Perhaps some who want to make this figurative may not appreciate the effects of a world without wind, and thus may not see a judgment in the no wind statement. So I had to walk through that with you a little bit. You say, well, no wind. Boy, I like a place like that. You know, the women would have to fix their hair all the time. They can go outside, you know, without coats, and it's just wonderful to be outside and no wind, you know. I look forward to the days when there are no wind, right? When these 30-mile-an-hour winds are over the weekend and it doesn't bring any rain, I hope that we go back to our, you know, 5-mile-an-hour wind. But we've got to have wind. Our world doesn't function without wind. And with stops, it's a judgment in the way the world functions under the curse. Was there wind in the Garden of Eden? I don't think so. But that's a different world. Remember, in the millennium, it's going to be made new, so we go back to that world. Okay, now, I'm going to get into the 144,000. Verse 3 says, do not harm the earth, it says to the wind. Do not harm the earth. When it does stop, so do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees until we have sealed the bond servants of our God on their forehead. So I wonder sometimes, well, how can the hot earth, the lack of wind, earth, not, how can it harm the sea? Well, I don't know, but I remember I never did fly a float plane, but my instructor told me, he says, if you ever do, that you find that you never want to land on a placid lake. I mean, any place where the water is absolutely still, because when that airplane pontoon hits the water, it'll suck it right in, because the surface tension pulls it in. So always want to have ripples on the water. So you scoot. So the surface tension fingers are broken up. Now, I don't know. That's a small thing about water. So it's a dangerous place. Well, what could be better than a placid lake? Not if you're in an airplane. You don't want to land on it. So there are all kinds of things that we don't know anything about in terms of the sea and how the weather affects it. But this placid condition on the earth apparently affects the sea somehow. Maybe it's more than just airplanes can't land on it. But can you imagine the ocean being just totally flat without any ripples? I'm not sure it's possible. I don't know how it would be possible, because we've got wave action, tidal action that would, but maybe those are waves that don't occur, you know, those are surges that don't cause waves. A lot of questions. Anyway, you have the picture of Gustav, what's his name, Dor. We were at his studio in Nuremberg, Germany. And I try to find the four winds of these guys up here. I love art. Here's one up here. There's one here. And there's one here. But I'm not sure this, unless this is the fourth. Somewhere in here there's a face. If you can see it, good for you. I just love art. Especially old art like that. Line art. Where they try to express something with angels still have wings. Okay, let's get to 144,000, since it's probably the most enigmatic thing for a lot of people. It's not that difficult if you are a dispensationalist like we are. I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe, the sons of Israel. Oh, man, is that true? Is that, ugh, man, that can't be true. It can be true. All right. It says there are 144,000 from every tribe. There are 12,000 from each tribe, I'm not going to exposit every verse here. You know this is what it says. There are 12,000 from each tribe of the 12 tribes confirmed by a good math, 144,000 are sealed. They are the sons of Jacob, 12 sons of Jacob. A little trip up here. The listing in the Bible is not always the same with the sons. Joseph had two sons. We got to take one out because they didn't get any land. We have also Dan sometimes missing. We don't know why, but they were so bad. Maybe they lost their position, which can't be because that's not God's grace. But we have these different listings in the Bible. They're not always the same. So we will not, in this class, try to unravel all that in this study, just to note that there are variations. Always end up with 12 sons, 12 territories, 12 allotments of the land. And in this case, 12,000 from every of the 12 tribes. The more significant issue is the attempt of the anti-Semitic theologians who want to write the Jewish people out of any future hope as a nation. That's the disappointment. Therefore, great effort is made to explain why the 144,000 are not Jews, even though they came from the 12 tribes who are Jews. In a dull repetition, it's given in the Bible. It makes the point that these evangelists are Jews. Got it? J-E-W-S, four letters. They're Jews from the tribes of Jacob. Jews. But they're the church. They say it's the church. And the Jehovah's Witness says they're us. They do. And noteworthy is all other theologians except dispensational premillennialists, like we are, makes the 104,000 something else than the Jews. Yet that everybody else doesn't recognize the Jewish element in this promise. They're trying to make it something else. Hubris, I call it. Gentile hubris. The historic premillennialist George Elton Ladd, who destroyed dispensationalism in the 50s and the 60s, Fuller Seminary, dismisses the 144,000 as Jews on the basis of a variant listing of the tribes. This is what he says. These 12 tribes cannot be literal Israel because they are not the 12 tribes of the Old Testament. The list here appears nowhere else in the Bible. Therefore, they're not Jews. Talk about a non sequitur. That doesn't follow at all. So the lists do vary. That's true. And on the basis that they vary, they can't be Jews. Scratch my head again. There is a better solution to explain why the lists vary than to throw the entire list out and make it the church. This list has no correspondence with the church. The Jehovah's Witness made this mistake and had to change their numbering system, but not their ID of the 144,000 when they outgrew their own numbers. And I say, oops. They used to say 144,000, that's all they are. Those are the ones that are the saved. They're the Jehovah's Witness. And then by, I don't know what's called God's grace, I don't know what the word is here, they grew bigger than 144,000. Now we got to redefine who they are, and I don't know how they do it. But I'm sure they got a way of doing it that's convincing to them. Okay, now we're done here, except to wrap up. So any questions? Individual 144,000 air-breathing, land-walking, dark-skinned, what else do I need to say? Jews. Absolutely. They've been sealed, and I think that sealing was the part mark of their faith. That's right. They were not saved at the rapture. Remember, we already know ahead of time from Genesis, Revelation 11, I think it is, that the two witnesses are out there. Hey, you know what my prayer is? That if these are guides that we get to love and enjoy in Israel, who know the whole story from all of us guys, will say when the rapture occurs, says, oops, I'm ready, you know, and they believe. All right, so I could say, you know, that would be a scenario for a lot of these. That's 144,000 isn't very many. You know, we talk about on the earth there are, 14 million Jews? Seven in here and seven there? That's right. Okay, now let's just kind of roll up what we already know in some sequence here. The rapture has occurred. The church has been judged and rewarded. A rearview mirror, that's behind us. The focus continues on earth. Although we have two glimpses in heaven. We'll see one in chapter 7. I believe Ezekiel war happens after the rapture, but before the beginning of the tribulation, in a short period of time. I'm not going to predict. But with the departure of the church, the day of the Lord can commence. So I think once the church leaves, the day of the Lord starts. because God takes up visible, active control of things on the earth. The Antichrist easily signs a peace guarantee that is deceptive, but is accepted by Israel. The major threatening nations around Israel have been neutralized by the Ezekiel War. By the signing of the peace guarantee, the judgment of the tribulation begins like a trickling hourglass. Time cannot be stopped. So what I'm saying, and the Antichrist easily signs a guarantee because there's really no opposition to him. See, that's one of the problems I have with the old way of looking at it. It says, how in the world would anybody ever, ever guarantee Israel sovereignty in their land with everybody around them, an enemy? Well, you take their enemy out, Islam, take them out, they're all of a sudden, oh, yeah, I could see that real easily. Now, I'm guessing on things here, but it seems that would work. Now, one thing we have not mentioned is the beginning of the two witnesses for the 1,260 days. This must be in the first half of the 7 years. Not covered it yet. Thus, with the signing of the covenant with the Antichrist, the two witnesses see the folly of the agreement and begin to witness against it and to wait for the coming of the preacher, for the coming of the Messiah. So seals 1 through 6 happen with political, military, and natural upheavals, and we saw one today even with the stopping of the wind. During this time, many die as martyrs who then cry out for deliverance. But wait, more must be added to the witness group. That's the end of chapter 7. The physical loss is 25% of the population of the earth in an easy part of the tribulation. Remember, the first half is an easy part. Then in our lesson today, after the sixth seal, but before the seventh, an interlude to provide background information for the coming days. The great judgment is coming, but first we are informed about the 144,000 witnesses that supposedly are from all quarters of the earth. Jews are everywhere. And immediately useful as evangelists. They don't have to go to missionary school. They are culturized. They are geographically in place to make the great impact on the entire world. Supposing 75% survived to this point, the ratio of evangelists to population is 36,000 to 1. That means, on average, that a city like Lincoln area would have about 6 evangelists, and I would say they will be quite effective. Now, the question of the wind, a direct judgment, or lack of wind, or allusions to judgment, are raised in the beginning of chapter 7. If it is the lack of wind on the earth, which would be a miracle, at least that we can't understand how it would happen, that alone would provide severe judgment. If it, holding back the winds, is an expression of God's delaying his coming judgment, which is the other view, the difference is slight. Yet in one case, the judgment is known, what it's going to be, lack of wind, stagnant atmosphere. In the other case, the judgments are unspecified, unless you look at all the trumpet judgment, the bowl judgment, as what's will come from. There's no connection made with those judgments. So now we're set, ready to go into the next section, Revelation 7, 9, and look at the martyrs, whose numbers are growing.
Do we know in the real world, the scientific world today, how long it would take for a lack of wind to result in judgmental conditions?
No. One thing that haunts me in the back of my mind about this is a little bit, and this is going to seem really weird. If, and there's a lot of ifs in what I say, if the world was thrown out of kilter at the flood and it's going to be put back into kilter during the tribulation, which I think it has to be, or else we'll have the same world we have now, we've already been told in the seal judgment that the world's been shaken, that mountains have been moved out of their place, the islands have gone from the sea. So I'm wondering whether the axis of the earth is already beginning to shift or has shifted back to a normal state, and that would agree for why it stays the same. The weather would be diminished. But that's just a wild guess. I wish somebody was a scientist would do this stuff instead of me. And I'm, you know, somewhere, somehow, I think the earth has to go back to its 360-day year. How does it gain its mass back that it lost? I don't know. There are always miracles. I understand that. So, and maybe the theory that the 360-day year is not original is possibly flawed, but it seems so terribly odd to me that you have 365 and a quarter days for a year when the Bible never talks about that kind of year. Always talk about 360 days. Always 360 days. And the world's weather changed when Noah got off the ark. So something happened in the flood. And it does say in the tribulation that the world is going to wobble and tilt and shake and all this kind of stuff. So I think that's sort of a statement that's going back the way it was. All right, we're not done with that discussion yet. And next week we'll dig into seven. It's about the martyrs. I almost thought I might go over that really quick, but there are some issues in that maybe we need to talk about, because we're now stopping in the middle of seven and looking back into heaven, what's going on in heaven, and we see elders up there, so maybe it needs a little bit of explanation. We'll try to do that next week. Let's pray. Thank you, Lord, for the morning, for the opportunity to be together as a class. Lord, thank you for your graces in our life. Lord, for the salvation that you have visited upon us, those of us have believed, and we trust that all have. And Lord, thank you for those that have been missing in our back now in our fellowship for illnesses and repair. Pray, Lord, you might continue to heal them, strengthen them, to restore them to full capacity and service for you. Thank you, Lord, for this local church and for the teaching of the word that we receive in all the classes and the message that we are going to enjoy the next hour, for the music and the aspect and the people that assemble here. Lord, thank you, Lord, for all of them, each one of them, as they seek to honor your name. Bless now as we go to the services, and keep us safe as we come back in next week. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.